This is Line One, Your Health Connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers, and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon, and welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. And before I introduce my guest, I'm going to move into an area that I haven't done. Kind of a subtext that I like to think about the program is we're not only trying to provide very good, very reliable health information, I'm trying to teach people ways that we know we can think a little bit clearer and make good decisions. And one of those is to understand the concept of logical fallacies, which have been around for a long time. A logical fallacy is something that appears maybe to be correct but doesn't stand up to evidence and principles. And there's a number of these, and one of them is argument from authority. This is a time when there's a lot of information out there about candidates, and there's a lot of logical fallacies being used. But I want to use a different example for argument from authority. One is that that may be a good example is that if an author is a best-selling author about a subject, particularly a medical subject, one might draw the conclusion that they're an expert on that. I want to use the example of Kevin Trudeau. Kevin Trudeau has recently been ordered to pay about a little over $5 million in profits from his book because of his comments and infomercials about his book, The Weight Loss Cure They Don't Want You to Know About. It turns out this is about the second time that he's been found in contempt of court in the past 4 years by stating that what goes on in his book about diet is easy to do, can be done at home, and ultimately allows eaters to eat whatever they want. None of that turns out to be true, and so he was slapped with this very significant penalty. Back to argument from authority. You might think that if someone can sell enough books and fool enough people into buying it, that they're an authority. Argument from authority fallacy says that the truth of a claim really should be ultimately based on the logic and evidence, not the authority of the person promoting it. So when listening to proposed experts, keep in mind you want to think critically about that information. My guest today is Margaret Werenberg. She's a doctor of psychology, a licensed clinical psychologist. She's an expert in the treatment of anxiety and depression. She's also had extensive training and expertise in the neurobiology of psychological disorders. She's written several books, the most recent of which is two of them, The Anxious Brain, The Neurological Basis of Anxiety Disorders and How to Effectively Treat Them. And then I became aware of her from reading the 10 Best Ever Anxiety Management Techniques, Understanding How Your Brain Makes You Anxious and What You Can Do to Change It. Dr. Werenberg, welcome to Line One.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Let's jump right in, and I always often like to start by describing or defining what we're talking about. How would you define anxiety, since that's what we're going to be dealing with today?
I think anxiety is the suspicion or apprehension that something bad's about to happen, that there is some danger of some kind, and it creates a sense in your whole body and your whole brain of being on alert for bad things, and that is a very unpleasant sensation. It can be that you're worried about having panic, or it can be that you're worried about whether or not you'll be socially rejected, two very different kinds of worries, but nonetheless, the sense that something bad could go wrong and you're on the alert watching for it.
And as we've discussed in this program before, that is good and bad. There's times when it might be very reasonable for an organism to be thinking about what might go wrong, but then at times it can overwhelm you and cause some problems.
And that's why anxiety by itself is not a disorder until it starts to get in the way of you being healthy, you thinking clearly, and you being able to live your life in a state that's mostly free of anxiety, where you can resolve what the things are that you're worried about.
Let's perhaps also discuss some of the symptoms of anxiety. I suspect a lot of our listening audience recognizes some, but then they may not recognize other things that they feel that might also indicate some anxiety?
Well, I think anxiety breaks into physiological symptoms, mental symptoms, and behavioral symptoms. Physical symptoms can be like a panic attack where you have a rapidly racing heart, shortness, shallow of breath, but then also symptoms that are maybe not so dramatic, dizziness or sensations of tingling or even numbness can go with this kind of anxiety. Often people with really intense panic attack end up in the hospital, but they're checking out whether or not they're having a heart attack, and then they're told they're having an anxiety attack. But there are, in fact, much milder but equally troubling symptoms. Generalized anxiety disorder symptoms could be a sense of being very, very nervous, of having a lump in your throat or a lot of muscle tension and tightness. It feels very unpleasant. Sometimes it could be described as walking around with a sense of physical dread. The way that you feel when the phone rings at 2 in the morning is the way I sometimes describe that.
Sure.
Mentally, I think the worst mental issue is worrying and being able to just stop your brain from chewing on problems. So cognitively, we're looking at interrupting ruminating worry. And the other thing is addressing the kind of problem you introduced the show with, these kind of mental fallacies. People have sometimes wrong beliefs that we have to get at, the belief that it would be horrible to be rejected, the belief that they can't do things the right way and it will always be their fault. Those are kind of mental false beliefs that people believe and then they worry about. And then there's the behavioral things, which are all the things that people do to get away from what they believe triggers their anxiety, even though they may eventually avoid way too many things. You could mentally avoid, like a very common one is people who are concerned about their medical health. They then try to avoid anything on the radio or the TV or in the newspaper that discusses the health condition they're afraid of, whether it's colon cancer or whether it's a heart problem or whether it's a disorder like lupus. They do mental cartwheels to avoid it. Or they try to literally avoid situations like people who are afraid to speak up in a classroom, take a test, get on an airplane, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Line 1. My guest today is Margaret Werenberg. She's an expert on anxiety, and that's really the topic. If you've got questions about something you hear today, some experiences you've had, or questions in general about approaching anxiety and its treatment or understanding it, why don't you give us a call today? Our local number is 550-8433. 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and you can reach us by email at lineone, lineone, at kska.org. And those of you who are often like to listen in the evening, as we rebroadcast, we're going to be playing this evening after a program called Running, which is on some of the candidates that are looking for election. So it would be after that tonight, sometime after 7 o'clock. The interaction between psychosocial issues, particularly anxiety, and healthcare is an interesting one. We were talking about before we came on the air. I'd like your comments about how that interaction may occur, and maybe some specific examples of why people may end up in a doctor's office when the issue is just anxiety.
Well, one of the most obvious reasons is there are so many physical symptoms that go with anxiety, from kind of issues related to heart and blood pressure, that people would seek out medical care first because it feels like a physical problem. However, I think a much underrated but frequent cause of people going to a medical doctor when, in fact, the problem is anxiety is that people with anxiety worry about how they feel. They notice aches or pains or quirks, and they also physically feel bad. If you're worrying a lot, your stomach could be upset. You could have more pain-related issues like TMJ or headaches or backaches, or your irritable bowel could be worse, or your digestion could be bad because you're worrying. And so people feel those obvious physical problems, and they go to a medical doctor because they think, oh, I will get a diagnosis and a medication and relief, mm-hmm. and then I will feel better. And so the number of visits to primary care doctors prompted by anxiety are enormous. I think the statistic is over 50%, although I'd have to go look that up. I think it's really huge how many visits are prompted by anxiety.
Right. Yeah, I've quoted the findings of a book called Caring for Patients by a man who's now, or a physician who's now died, but ran the outpatient clinic at Stanford University for a long time. And his studies looking at people who came into the outpatient clinic there was about a third of them had purely medical problems, a third had purely psychosocial problems, and another third had medical problems, but the primary reason they were there was psychosocial problems related to the medical problems. So that basically two-thirds of the issues in an outpatient medical, family or family practice, outpatient, primary care really is not medical in origin.
And that puts quite a burden on primary care docs to spot the psychosocial issue going on when that's not what they are primarily trained to pay attention to.
Right.
All
right, we have a caller, Dr. Wehrenberg. Let's go ahead and take her. Chrissy, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi there. I wanted to talk a little bit about how the symptoms might be different in adolescents.
Okay.
We had a son who appeared, we just thought he was very shy, and he didn't like to go out to dinner, always had trouble, and he would be nauseous a lot in the mornings. We always had a sensitive gag reflex, and he would vomit, brushing his teeth in the morning. Usually at the beginning of the school year, it was very tough for him, and as he got older and the symptoms got worse, we finally did go see, because he was starting to have some symptoms of depression with it. And it turned out he has social anxiety disorder, mm-hmm. and he got on some medication, and it was just life-changing for him. And we just did not, the symptoms seemed like a shy kid. We just didn't see that there was an actual anxiety problem.
Right.
Thank you, and I'll take information off the air.
Okie doke.
Well, so you're asking about whether or not symptoms look different in adolescence, and when maybe shyness is really an anxiety issue. And it's a dilemma, truly, because many, many shy children become socially anxious because they have a very sensitive, and I don't mean that in any negative way, they're just very sensitive to the reactions of other people. They can be very attuned and empathic to others, but also overestimate the degree to which they're going to be rejected, or overestimate how challenging a problem is going to be for them. And it feels worse to them to be anxious than it feels to a child who doesn't have shyness. What we really want to look for is helping shy children and shy adolescents to identify their strengths, to really build as many positive exchanges with other children and in academic settings as we can, to build their sense of confidence and their competencies. The problem with letting shy children withdraw, and it certainly sounds like you did not do this, was that if you let a child pull back, then they will miss out on learning social competence and academic competence and all the competencies that come from participating in teams and band and choir and all those other activities that kids do. So really we have a huge issue in the realm of prevention, which is to help shy children develop competence and confidence that helps them get over the anxiety, and then giving them, of course, from my perspective, anxiety management skills.
Mm-hmm. You know, this brings up an issue in my mind that it seems like somewhere I had heard that anxiety, and this may not be the right term, comes from an increased number of negative experiences, whereas people who have increased number of positive experiences are less likely to have anxiety. And the subtext here, again, is that many people have the biggest thing that they may say would give me anxiety is getting up in front of a lot of people and talking. And yet people who may do that quite easily may have social phobia, social anxiety. So that it may, you know, it may seem funny, but again, it gets back to these positive and negative experiences and how you're dealing with those. Does that make sense? And is it helpful to put that into that context like that?
Yeah, I think that's an important point. It's actually a really important point for helping someone with anxiety. Every person experiences anxiety when we're doing something new. How's it going to turn out? We kind of put ourselves in the future. What will happen if it works? What will happen if it doesn't work? And there is a group of people, particularly the socially anxious person, who experiences that anxiety more intensely as awful to feel. That level of anxiety that a outgoing, more impervious child may feel anxiety, but also feel highly rewarded by the outcome. So there's an issue of how much fear do I feel, how bad does it feel to me, and how good does it feel when I get to the other side and accomplish something. And it's speculated that people who develop social anxiety, especially the ones that you see shy in childhood and adolescence, are feeling their anxiety as more aversive, much less pleasant than another child might, and that they feel less reward from the accomplishment. And that's determined by biology.
Mm-hmm.
So consequently, they have a greater number of unrewarding experiences. And they have then a tendency to overestimate how likely it is that a future experience will be bad. And what we see is this cascade of either going out feeling scared, and that's what you remembered, well, I did that and I felt really scared, mm-hmm. and they don't really feel the reward. Or they go out and they make a mess of it because they're so anxious, and they say, see, I really can't do that. So it becomes, anxiety becomes self-reinforcing in that way. I hope I said that clearly,
because
that's such an important point.
Right. But there is, I guess the other thing I heard you is this nature-nurture argument. There are, at least in my experience, I'll put it that way, individuals who seemed, from the time I first start seeing them as children, to have a higher level of baseline anxiety. They're a little bit more at risk from my point of view. And then there's people at the other end of that probable bell-shaped curve as well that seem to handle stress and anxiety extremely, extremely well.
I think that's absolutely true. And one of the difficulties that we have in producing really top-notch evidence for that is that we haven't done much yet with examining the brains of infants and then watching them as they grow over 20 years. But when you examine people who have diagnoses of social anxiety, you can see that they have different brain structure and some different brain neurotransmitter levels. So there are definite biological differences that make this child and then adult more sensitive to anxiety. Panic attack appears to be genetically determined for people who suffer panic that's not caused by a specific trauma. Like, any person could, for example, be in a natural disaster or a traumatic accident and start to have panic attacks after that. But some people are just born with panic. That appears to be a genetically triggered experience. And people with generalized anxiety, sort of the worry warts among us, who can actually very often tolerate large doses of anxiety, way more than the socially anxious person, but they may have this sort of high-energy worry brain that doesn't turn off, which is, again, an issue of neurotransmitter function. So we have biological underpinnings, but every time a bad experience reinforces the anxiety gets stronger, and that's where the cognitive or psychological component comes in.
From a neural physiologic standpoint, I find myself using the following example to help people understand how we can sometimes get into ruts neurologically of which one might be anxiety. And that is, you know, if you, as a child growing up, you learn to ride a bike, and for the rest of your life, it's pretty easy to learn to remember how to ride that bike. You've kind of set up neural pathways and circuits that have been reinforced over and over, and they become more set. And I don't know that that's entirely accepted as the way things are happening in our brain, but also anxiety, if we use that same analogy, if we're having repeated negative experiences or we have one big one that makes us affects us dramatically, and then subsequently we have more worry about the future, it kind of continues to reinforce and in a sense snowball that issue. Is that kind of what you were implying about what you have to do psychologically to break that habit or break that way of thinking?
It is exactly that, and I would maybe even go a little bit farther than saying it's not just a snowball effect when there's an experience, mm-hmm. but people can, in fact, create that neurobiological rut by imagining that things don't go well, imagining the bad thing has happened. People can literally scare themselves. Mm. And then they respond to future experiences as if they've had the bad experience. So we're these amazingly complex creatures, and we can scare ourselves by creating frightening scenarios in our minds. So when we're going to do something new, for example, somebody approaching an airplane ride, let's say they've never had one before. One person is excited and says, this is going to be fun. I can't wait to see what it's like. And another person imagines how horrible it's going to be, and they can't stand the idea that somebody's going to shut the door, and oh, how awful it will be when I look down and see how high I am in the air. And what each person is doing neurobiologically, one is creating a positive rut and the other is creating a negative rut. But when we do treatment, we work very hard at breaking up that negative neurological pattern and creating new positive patterns, and really focus a lot of attention on creating new positive patterns that people consistently review and create and rehearse in order to form new neurological networks in their mind.
Before we get too far away from the general idea of anxiety, my reading is that there's about specialists in the area will divide anxiety into about five major types. Do you want to let us know how you think about it and maybe describe those, how you break that issue of anxiety up?
Yes, there's five major types of anxiety. We have panic disorder, which is diagnosed as with agoraphobia or without agoraphobia, which is the fear of going out in public. And agoraphobia by itself is always diagnosed as with or without panic. So usually with panic, there's some component of avoiding going out into the world, not necessarily, but usually. Then there's generalized anxiety disorder, which is really intensive, disruptive worry, primarily. Ruminative worry is the primary feature of that. And sometimes that looks a little bit like obsessive-compulsive disorder, but OCD has a very different underlying biology and a very different treatment, and it has the additional component of people doing mental or physical ritual behaviors to relieve anxiety, and those behaviors often become hugely disruptive to living their life. Excessive hand-watching, locking the doors over and over and over and over and over, checking on things repeatedly, hoarding, etc. Those are very specific symptoms to OCD that you won't necessarily see with someone who's just got generalized anxiety, which is fretting and worrying. And then there's post-traumatic stress disorder, which is something that obviously is triggered by a trauma. Post-traumatic stress is so much more than anxiety, though, and it really is often coupled with feelings of depression or self-destructiveness. It's often accompanied by flashbacks to the negative experience that triggers the sense of fear all over again. And it's always triggered by an event that is outside the realm of normal human experience, in which the person had a fear they could die or had a near-death experience, or that a loved one might die. So it's very clear that the origin of that disorder is in a traumatic experience. And then finally, social anxiety, which we've been discussing quite a bit so far, which is not just public speaking. Social anxiety is an intense reaction to the idea that in a social interaction, it could be signing a credit card in public, it could be eating in a restaurant, sitting in a movie theater, raising your hand in a classroom to answer a question, anything where you would be noticed and observed. So I call it sort of a fear of exposure, and the fear is the fear that I will look afraid, and then someone will reject me or humiliate me because of it. And so people avoid dating, they avoid parties, they avoid even achievements where they might be noticed publicly for achieving, because the fear of being noticed is intense. So that's the maybe too long wrap up, but those are the insights.
That's fine. I want to take a second again and remind our listeners this is Line 1, your health connection on KSKA in Anchorage. And also I need to let you know a few times each year KSKA needs to remind us how important all of our financial support is to programs like this one, Line 1. So here's my colleague Lynn Anderson to tell us a little bit more.
KSKA is celebrating 30 years of public radio service in South Central Alaska this year. And right now we're inviting you to call 550-8484 and pledge your financial support to keep KSKA's local news and information programs going strong on FM 91.1. Toll free, the number is 800-478-5256. Or you can pledge online, kska.org/support. 91.1 FM is where to tune for local, statewide, and national news and information. Each week, KSKA's locally produced call-in programs, Line 1, Your Health Connection, Talk of Alaska, Alaska's only statewide call-in program, and Community Forum, invite you to call in with your questions and comments on issues important to you. Dr. Thad Woodard, Steve Heimel, and Nellie Moore keep you connected with your community by inviting guests and experts who offer insight and information on the issues that matter to you. Call in with your pledge of support, 550-8484 or 800-478-5256. Online, kska.org/support. KSKA, the Alaska Public Radio Network, NPR, and the BBC all work together to provide the best news and information public service on radio today. You need KSKA, and KSKA needs you. In Anchorage, call 550-8484, toll-free 800-478-5256, or online, kska.org/support. Thanks for listening, and thank you for supporting KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back to Line 1. My guest today is Margaret Wehrenberg, and she's an expert on anxiety, and we're discussing that topic today. If you have questions or comments about your personal experiences or what you hear today on Line 1, why don't you give us a call? Our local number, 550-8433, toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can email us at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at ksk.org. Dr. Wehrenberg, we do have an email from a guest named Heather, and she would like you to discuss the connection between anxiety and seasonal affective disorder. She goes on to generalize a little bit more about why are anxiety and depression linked, and why is anxiety a depression symptom for some and not for others. So I guess the issue is, what's the relationship between depression and anxiety in a more general sense?
Well, there's actually about a 50% overlap between having some form of depression and some type of anxiety at the same time. And that's probably related to the underlying neurobiology. Most often we talk about that as what happens when people have insufficient levels of a neurochemical called serotonin. Serotonin is linked also to seasonal affective disorder because of its impact on producing melatonin in the brain, which is, again, that's that link to responding to light and dark. But the lower serotonin level tends to create a lot of negativity, or I shouldn't say it creates it, it results in the brain creating too much negativity. You actually need to have a healthy supply of neurotransmitters to push away negativity, to look on the bright side. I talk about this sometimes as the brain has a protective aspect to look out for things that could be trouble and then help us avoid them or solve the problem. And anxiety is, in a way, kicking in with depression to try and problem solve, but it's ineffective. It becomes kind of ruminative. And with depression, we've got so much negativity that it's difficult to solve that, because it just is a feeling of negativity, even in the face of the evidence that you ought to feel negative. And when we're looking at the underlying neurochemistry, it's probably related to a low level of serotonin, or insufficient level, or inability to transfer it across from one cell to the other, but problems in that serotonin delivery system somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right, so they're intimately related and often overlap at least half of the time, is what I'm hearing you say.
Yes.
Kiddo. This is a comment that caught my attention because of its simplicity, and at least to me it seemed kind of wise. I heard it at a lecture one time, and I think the topic probably was anxiety or depression. I don't remember which, but the advice from the speaker at the time was, you know, some good advice to the patient would be, don't think about the future. And if you think about that, that's pretty simple. And often, as you've implied already, most of what we worry about or we're anxious about is not the past, not the current. It's what might happen in the future. That's easy to say, not necessarily easy to follow through with, but I'd like your thoughts on that suggestion.
I think it's a terrific suggestion, and it is exactly what drives people with anxiety even more anxious when they can't stop doing it. And what I say, this is such a difficult issue. So often in the United States, at any rate, we want to throw medication at a problem. And in truth, medication sometimes helps people who are really trapped in anxiety or depression to get a hold of themselves and be able to employ strategies. But what therapy can do for somebody who's worried about the future and would prefer to follow that excellent advice, not to think about it, they need some strategies for how to get a hold of their runaway thoughts. And that's what people can get in therapy.
Tell us what kinds of specific therapies are used. How are they done? How many times would you give us some examples of how often a visit may be necessary to help people really learn to control some of their anxiety? And then a sub-thought of that to me is, what about the person who has this already underlying, almost genetic predisposition? How much more difficult is that to treat? And can it be? Can that amount of anxiety that seems to be genetic really be controlled also in a psychological setting versus the medication setting?
Well, then specifying the number of sessions is always a little bit of a challenging question, because every individual history is different. And I may have someone to treat who's just got, you know, wonderful background and has had the perfect, loving, supportive family and no psychological trauma and no personality disorder, who just has this tendency to worry. And they're going to leap in and absorb these strategies and apply them and do very well. And I can see that person once a week for 12 or 15 or maybe 20 times, and they've got a lifetime of strategies established. Whereas somebody else who's come up in the world in a very difficult environment may need all those strategies and learn them in 12 or 20 sessions, but then, because of their history, need to work through some of the ways that history creates blocks or obstacles. So the exact length of therapy is a little challenging, but managing anxiety as a bunch of strategies is not real difficult to do in therapy, and teaching the strategies can be done in, as I suggested, a time-limited frame. It may mean some tweaking to get them to work. But I will also tell you that even genetically determined anxiety, somebody who's just born as a worrier or born as a socially anxious person, needs strategies. And those strategies that they can learn in therapy will be very effective at calming the brain down so it doesn't generate so much anxiety, desensitizing, if you will, and then providing a lifetime of, I can manage this, it doesn't have to be a problem anymore. Mm-hmm. So even people who remain a little bit shy, to a negative extent, I don't mean, there are lots of people who are shy who don't have a psychological disorder, or people who are worriers who tend under stress to resort to worrying, can always use these strategies to stay calm. The real definition of anxiety disorder is when the anxiety starts to interfere with your ability to think, do your work, relate to people, have a fulfilled life that's reasonably contented, where you can solve your problems and get through them without anything that's self-destructive. And that's where you need strategies from therapy. Medication can make you more able to learn the strategy because it calms you down. But it does not take the issue away until you learn how to cope with it.
I've heard it said increasingly, I think, that even with issues such as attention deficit disorder, perhaps depression, anxiety, obsessive compulsive, that medications may control symptoms, but they really don't affect the brain as we begin to understand the neurobiology, and that the long-term benefits of change in the neural circuitry, if we will, and these transmitters we're talking about really comes from the psychological treatments that teach us how to handle this on the long term. Is that make sense?
I would have to agree that that's a likely very true statement, mm-hmm. That when we're talking about changing these neural networks, it's creating new alternative neural networks that really makes the biggest change, and medication doesn't do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let me remind our listeners one more time. This is Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Margaret Warrenburg. She's an expert on the treatment of anxiety and depression and an author on a number of textbooks. I'm going to ask her at least one anxiety management technique from her book, The 10 Best Ever Anxiety Management Techniques, shortly. But if you've got questions or comments, you can reach us at 550-8433 locally, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And by email at line1, you have to spell it out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at kska.org. Another listener has emailed in and wants to know, is there a connection between stress and fibromyalgia, and also, do you know if smells, such as industrial smells and so forth, might somehow contribute to anxiety? Two separate questions, it appears to me.
Okay. Stress and fibromyalgia, that's a very challenging question, but because I think that research is beginning to look very seriously at how stress has such a powerful impact on inflammation in the body, and I think that could be related to at least feeling worse from fibromyalgia, so that stress could trigger more pain, perhaps. We know that stress depletes supplies of neurochemistry, and so any issue where you feel pain or tension gets worse when stress is ongoing. And the problem, of course, with any autoimmune disorder is that anything that increases inflammation is probably going to have a toll on that. Not being a medical doctor, I don't know all the ins and outs of fibromyalgia, but I also know that when you reduce stress and when you help people manage anxiety so that they have less tension and are more resilient to stress, that their symptoms of fibromyalgia or chronic fatigue syndrome become lessened. Mm-hmm. They get improvement in those symptoms. The other one was about industrial smells, and I wish I knew more about that. But I suspect any time you are getting a toxin into your system, you've got to do something about cleansing it from your system. And I don't know that it could specifically cause anxiety, but worrying about whether it's making you sick. Now, there's an anxiety disorder.
Right. And I was also making the conclusion or coming to the conclusion that maybe a prior experience that was an anxiety producing one may also at the same time been associated with a certain smell or so forth, and may, so that smell coming up would reactivate some anxiety. Is that a potential?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Okay. All right. Let's see. I would like to ask you about one of your best ever anxiety management techniques for everybody here at KSKA. It seems like this is a stressful time when we go into our fundraising period. So as a group gesture, would you give us all one of your 10 best ever anxiety management techniques?
I have a perfect one for all of you, in fact. And I call it worry well, but only once. This is an absolutely phenomenal tool if you can learn to use it truly. But it means that you have to take, you've got a legitimate concern. The future of our station, of our ability to produce quality programming, meet our commitment to the community, do the job we know we can do, depends on our success here. What if it doesn't come through and you're all worrying? Oh no. I'm hypothesizing. I don't know that you are.
We are. Or I am.
Well, here's what I would suggest for you in this case. You take the problem, what will happen if the money doesn't come through? And you worry about it one time, and maybe you all need to get together so you can worry about it really well.
Together.
And literally say, well, if the money doesn't come through at this level, what will happen? And if it doesn't come through at the next level, you can maybe pick a few levels of anticipated outcome. What will we do about it? Now, certainly you can look ahead and say, well, maybe we won't worry about that at all until we know exactly the amount of money we get, because we could say, what if nobody gives us a pledge? What if we get 90% of the pledge? Those might be very different, 90% of the budget, I mean. Those might be very different answers, and I'm going to say maybe it would be a waste of time to think about what you'll do if the money doesn't come in until you know the exact sum. But you could say to yourself, what should we worry about? Well, we should worry about putting on the best fundraiser we can. How will we go about that? Make your plan, put it in place, and then make your plan for evaluating the results. So on the day that you know how this worked out, get together and say, now let's brainstorm based on the amount of money that was pledged, what we're going to do from this day forward. So you've worried about how to make sure you get money. You've planned your fundraiser. You've put all the pieces of the plan in place. When are the radio spots going to air? Who's going to do them? What are their responsibilities? Because you're kind of making a plan here. And then you put in a point where you say, when is the next date that we should worry about this some more? And that's mm-hmm. on the day that you know the outcome. Mm-hmm. And so when it comes up to your mind, what if we don't get any money? What if we don't get enough money? You say to yourself, stop. I already worried. Mm-hmm. The next time I worry is, and then you put in the date, and then you do something that distracts you, and I call that the thought replacement. Mm-hmm. So after you worry well, now this could also apply, by the way, to like a medical test where you have a test and you go, oh no, what if it turns out that I have diabetes? Or, oh no, what if it turns out that I have cancer? Well, you can't answer that question until you know the result. But you can, for example, say, well, maybe I should check what my insurance coverage is so I make sure I'm talking to doctors that are in my plan. And maybe you should check that you have a friend or a spouse or a family member who will go with you to the doctor to listen, help you listen, It's okay. You call that person up and say, come with me when I get my results. And then you say to yourself, no, but what if I do have cancer? You say, stop. I already worried. I will think about that on the day I get my results.
Mm-hmm.
And so you push it off. And the key to making this worry well and only once work well is to have a list of thought replacements, things you're going to think about instead. And I don't mean just like visualize yourself on the beach. I mean just ordinary things that you can replace your thoughts with right away. And there's something that I call the 2P thought replacement list, which is thinking every day, literally every day, take 30 seconds in the morning to figure out and even write them down on a post-it note. Two things you can think about that are pleasant or productive, the 2P thought replacement list, and literally write them down. And it could simply be, oh, I have to go to the hardware store this afternoon. Let me think about my supply list of things I need to buy. It could be, I get to go to the movies this weekend. Which movie do I want to see? It shouldn't be, oh, no, what if I don't pass my geography test? You know, I don't want you to put on anything that's worrisome, but pleasant or productive. Maybe you're going to think about your next vacation. Maybe you want to think about, oh, I have a choice of sports activities to do on Saturday. Which one do I want to, you know, do? Depending on the part of the country, I can't think of a good Alaska example right off the top of my head. But I'm sure it's outdoorsy, whatever it is. But you want to think about something, mm-hmm. and every day it would be a little bit different because each day you have a life that's a little bit different. And so what you do with this list is when you go, stop, I already worried, then you look at your list and say, oh, yeah, I want to think about the hardware store. And you set up a new neural network that is mm-hmm. benign.
Right. Right.
And you just go off down that path and then let your thoughts wander away from there.
So you're setting up this neural network of every day thinking about two positive P things, and they're different each day, and it gets you in that habit over time of doing that.
And you said the magic words there. Gets you in the habit mm-hmm. of sending your thoughts in a positive or pleasant direction, productive direction instead of a worry direction. So you're literally creating this, you're getting out of the worry rut, literally, when mm-hmm. you say stop. You kind of jump your brain out of the worry rut, mm-hmm. and then you say, I already worried, if this is like a fundraising problem. I already worried, and then you go down this new neural network of pleasant or productive.
Okay.
Is that...
I'm feeling better. I've got some...
okay, good.
Actually, thinking about the question earlier about pain and stress and so forth, I'm very clearly a headache kind of guy, so I uh-huh. clearly get a painful thing that happens to me under stress and so forth, and I also have an increased appetite. We don't have to deal with those, but I want to make a point that you certainly can have discomfort related to anxiety, worry, and stress.
Well, and, you know, you're really so right about that. There is actually a connection between migraine and anxiety, a biological connection. There is also, however, though, for people who are worriers in particular, there is a biological tendency towards increased physical tension because of what underlies that intense worry. There's also a tendency to become physically tense, which creates head pain, neck pain, jaw pain, increases ulcer pain, back pain. Everything related to more tension gets worse for the worrying person, and it's caused neurobiologically. So relaxing your body on purpose can fight against that.
You know, maybe you're in the right business. We all need a little bit. you have a large group of potential clients out there.
I do have a pretty big potential client pool. That's true. You know, and I also want to say the issue about eating when you're under stress, it's a natural tendency to try and nurture yourself. women do it more than men even. Especially if it's work-related, you know, women visit the vending machine more often at work if mm-hmm. they're under stress. I think that a real anti-stress measure, though, is also eating mindfully, where instead of just willy-nilly shoving a bag of chips in your mouth and chewing, mm-hmm. that you get that bag of chips but preferably get something more healthful like an apple or something, and quietly sit somewhere and just eat the apple, paying attention to it.
Enjoy it.
You know, because a lot of our stress eating is when we're also doing something else. So I just want to suggest that if you're going to eat, really take the time to enjoy it, and it'll have much better stress-relieving benefits, and you'll end up eating less.
That sounds great. Especially for someone like me who eats so fast, I don't taste anything anyway. But anyway, we've got another caller. Let me take Billy. You've got a question for us, Billy?
Yes, I do.
What can we do for you?
Well, thank you for having me. And it's a really informative show, especially for our family. We come from a long line of worriers. But my son last year went through a severe, he was 9 at the time, went through severe anxiety. I've never seen anything like it. We couldn't figure it out. It seemed to come on suddenly, but it lasted for months. And he couldn't even function at school. He would just be in tears all day, worried about the wind blowing at 9, worried the fire bell was going to go off. You know, it was...
Yeah.
Oh, it was horrible, horrible. But what ended up happening, I just, through some random information, found out that the asthma medicine he was on, they were discovering caused anxiety, and he was already predisposed to it. But once we took him off that, within a month, he was able to function again. But I'm still concerned after hearing about the rut. Do you think, you know, CBT or behavioral therapy or something could still be useful after that?
Well, first of all, I'm so glad for you that you found a way to give him relief. It's sad to see a child burdened that way. It's so hard on everybody. I will also tell you, though, that this is an exaggerated evidence of something I said. Anxiety is a condition looking for a content. When you have an anxious brain, whether it's caused by a medication or a genetic component, sounds like your son had the mixed blessing there of both, is that his brain is feeling anxiety is going to look around for a reason.
Yes.
And so kids come up with, and so do adults, by the way, come up with ridiculous reasons for their worry. And so it's the, oh, no, the fire bell could go off. Mm-hmm. Oh, no, the wind could rattle the windows. You're saying that's not logical, and of course it isn't.
Right,
but
right.
At that moment, he can explain this terribly anxious feeling by making that reason up. He wants a reason for it. And adults do that in just a little bit more sophisticated way. So looking for ways to calm physiology is important. You asked, should he maybe have some strategies? And I would say absolutely. And the thing that is really true is that moms and dads can be very helpful to their children who are 8, 9, 10, 11, in that category, of teaching them to think about themselves as an author named Tamara Chansky says, think about your smart brain and what it would say to your worried brain. And she says children know when their worries are ridiculous, but they can't shake off the worry.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can help the child have a focus on what they know is true and right versus what they're so terrified of. Terror always wins, by the way.
Yeah.
Until you start to have the child talk back to the worry brain, as if their worry is not them. You want to give the child a sense of control over the worry. There are many, many other techniques like that for kids, but I think if you educated yourself a little bit about some simple cognitive behavioral interventions, you'd really help your son get some lifetime strategies. A lot of people who come from a long line of worriers, and I can attest to this one personally, benefit from knowing some strategies to interrupt different kinds of worries rather than give in to them.
Okay.
Well,
Thank you.
Let me interrupt. It sounds like your book, Dr. Warenberg, is designed for this purpose. It gives people some 10 very succinct strategies.
Exactly. It is. And all of the techniques in my book, the 10 best ever anxiety management techniques, can be used with children as well as with adults of any age.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for
your call. You're welcome.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Hi.
Bye.
It's amazing to me, but we're getting down to the end of the program again. Are there some myths that are important in the last minute or so that you think we ought to touch base on, or would you rather just sum up with some important ideas for us to remember?
I would say that anytime someone tells you to handle your anxiety by just not worrying, don't pay attention to them. Go out and get some help. Because the thing that I think prevents people from going to therapy is the idea that they should be able to handle this themselves. And I think what I would like people to know is that if you have a therapist who knows anxiety management techniques, and on my website I have a list of questions you should ask a therapist, you can get so much help so fast. So don't delay getting help. There's no reason to be miserable. That's what I'd like to say.
And I would remind our listeners, if you go to ksk.org/line1, we have Dr. Warrenberg's website and a couple of other links to important bits of information. And you mentioned Tamar Chansky, who I actually interviewed probably 5 or 6 years ago, who is also written extensively, particularly about children and anxiety and obsessive-compulsive disorder, I believe.
Yes, she's a wonderful author. There are several. In my book, I make reference to several other really fine authors that take different pieces of information, but also you'll find authors that talk about specific age groups or problems people face. So I'm not the only really good author out there.
Well, you've done a wonderful job of reminding me particularly, and hopefully some of us around here and all of us that are listening, about taking the time to think about not thinking about the future so much and some specific strategies. So I really want to say thank you for taking the time today.
I appreciate you having me so much. Thank you.
Well, good luck in the future.
I appreciate it.
All righty. Thanks to Dr. Margaret Warrenberg, our guest today. Next week, we're going to be returning, and we're going to be delving into indoor air quality. A lot of us think about outdoor air as a problem, but there's some indoor air quality issues, and we're going to have two experts, Ann Slepia and Scott Watterson, a waterman, I believe it is. I may be wrong about the name. I apologize. And they'll be talking about specific issues relating to health and indoor air quality and what we can do about preventing issues that affect health by controlling our indoor air. So tune into your health next Monday. And learn more on that'll be Monday, October 27th at 2 p.m. And remember, we repeat the same evening at 7 p.m. on FM 91.1. For KSKA and for Line 1, this is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
This has been Line 1, your health connection. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508, or email us at line1@kska.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at kska.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.